Welcome to CXO 4.0 from Sullivan & Stanley. In our first podcast series, I'm going to cover a multitude of topics for business leadership in the 21st century. We will examine topics ranging from dysfunctioning boards through digital innovations, ways of working, interim and fractional working, and on to C-suite of the future. With technology on tap, what do our leaders believe this means for leadership roles?
For those who do have the opportunity, whether it be in the C-suite or in some other forum, you know, just ask the question is, you know, could we do things differently? Could we do things better? How important is this to us? And you know, if everybody did that, I think the world of business, you know, and the world in general would be a very different place.
Well, hi, Nigel. Thank you for joining us on this podcast. Today's subject is around corporate social responsibility, a bit of a resurgence in that area of late. But what I'd like to do is just quickly ask you if you could tell us a little about yourself and why this subject resonates with you particularly.
Sure. Good to be here, Ken. I'm a technologist by profession and have spent my time working in various global companies and largely focused around consumer goods, but also utilities and one or two other sectors. But I've also been fortunate enough to have P&L roles and also work in different parts of the world. And CSR, I've been able to see it from a number of different angles, including time in South Africa, time in the US and here in the UK. And I think more and more, as we hopefully will go on discuss, I think it's something that technology executives can also play an ever-increasing role in.
Absolutely, yes. And I guess it'd be worth diving into a few of those organisations and what sort of focus they had on corporate social responsibility. We know that different corporates have different ideas about what that might mean, for example, depending on their industry, their ambitions and how they measure themselves.
Yeah, I think that's right. And as we're going to talk about, I've worked for a very controversial industry that many people would find it difficult to believe that there can be any good that comes out of that industry's activities, through to some very socially driven and purposeful at their heart organisations. In fact, their founding had an element of purpose and social impact about them. And I'm also now lucky enough to be part of a charity as a trustee, which is focused on social care. So I hope for you and for the listeners, I've got a kind of range of perspectives that will pull out some different examples, I think, of both where CSR largely started from as sort of corporate reputation on the edge of the organisation, to those organisations I've been lucky enough to work for where social responsibility and social purpose, probably the better term, is absolutely within the DNA of the organization.
Fantastic. We'll definitely dive into that. And so what are you doing right now? You're an interim, I understand.
Yeah, well, I'm between roles. And as this is being recorded during the COVID-19 pandemic, things have quietened down. I'm keeping myself busy with a little bit of consultancy and other things. So otherwise, no, I'm like everybody else, spending a lot of time at home. Going out when permitted and where permitted, but otherwise just trying to stay connected with people and understand, I guess, the situation we're all in and where it's going to take us.
And so when we dive into these organisations, well, let's have a go at that now. So yeah. The types of CSR activities that you've managed to see in different organisations, it'd be good to understand a bit more about that. And I guess also how overt they are about them, because I guess that would differ between organisations as well.
Yeah, no, and that's a great point. So let's start with let's go controversial to start with. So I worked for British American Tobacco for 9 years, both in head office and saw a little bit of CSR from that perspective, but then was also fortunate post a merger we did to go and live and work in South Africa, in our South African business, not long after the end of apartheid. And therefore, the combination of both being in tobacco, being a very dominant business in the new South Africa, and also being in the tobacco industry, provided a really interesting mix of perspectives from stakeholders and others as to what our industry was responsible for, and also the kind of things we could start to do to just not necessarily legitimize tobacco, but make people understand that, that there was a lot of good that, that the business and that particular part of the industry could have in a societal sense. So to answer your question, I suppose when I first got involved with BAT, there was a lot of work that was done to support the supply chain. So with farmers, tobacco farmers, ensuring that they got fair pricing, ensuring that their communities had schooling, had some of the basic elements. And that was all very quietly done in many respects, and really began to build up a bit of a CSR kind of label. But actually it had been done for some time in terms of just understanding how to support the ecosystem that we depended on, if you like, as an organization. But then it very much moved into a much more, I guess, deliberate strategy. And it came under, in the organizational sense, a function called CORA, Corporate and Regulatory Affairs. And that function, I guess, is like most organizations, corporate affairs. And they would look very much at both the internal support we could give employees, but also then externally. I think if I pick out a couple of really challenging projects that I did get involved in, the first one was when we were in South Africa, we began a process of stakeholder engagement and dialogue, which, great words, and sort of hear some of those words a lot in business. But what this actually meant was we would engage with every group of stakeholders that had an interest or connection with tobacco, including the most vocally anti the whole principle of tobacco and smoking, but also employees, farmers, retailers, both small and the large, the media. And what would happen is these groups of people would be got together and they would be asked questions and it was a very open discussion. And as execs, we had to sit behind the ring of stakeholders and stay silent. They were completely at liberty to say what they wanted about their views of the company, and each session was completely independently facilitated by a third party. And it was very interesting because some people chose not to engage, and that was unfortunate, but a lot of people did, even those who were very against the industry. And to hear the views of your company, your business, and what you do, unchallenged, unfiltered, from both very supportive people, but also those who know you well and do business with you and like some things about the way you do business and others, and those who absolutely, you know, disagree with your very existence, is a very eye-opening experience, and to have to sit there in silence and listen to it. So that was quite remarkable. And then on the other end of the scale, you know, one of the things we were able to do was we worked in the Eastern Cape with Madiba, Nelson Mandela's original homeland, to try and uplift the people from his region. We were engaged with him and his office, and this was in about 2000-2001. So he'd stepped down from being president at that stage, but was still very keen on, you know, black empowerment and social upliftment. And we came up with a plan, working with a couple of other organizations, to help them by creating a product they could grow and sell into various industries. And believe it or not, that was licorice. Licorice was both an ingredient in terms of many foods, obviously in sweets and confectionery, but also, interesting enough, it's a flavorant in certain blends of tobacco. And licorice was suitable for that area where they, in the Eastern Cape, in terms of the climate and the soil. And so off we went, and we bought tractors and the machinery they would need, and got the, you know, the sort of the project off the ground, if you like, with his support and everybody else's, and learned some very interesting lessons. What we collectively failed to do, and this is working with a consultancy that specialized in this, was understand that unless you build the understanding of how a tractor works, how it needs to be serviced, and the life of managing things through machinery, which these people had never had, they did a season, were very successful in growing the crops, but as soon as the tractor broke down, they left it in the field. And there was just that naivety on our behalf of walking in there, I guess, as people who thought they knew how to help these people move up in terms of their social liftment. And with the best of intents, we created some positive change, and obviously with some reworking and rethinking, we eventually got it off the ground and working properly. We really didn't spend the time to understand the need and understand the context. We took our view of sort of not exactly first world agriculture, but our more modern agriculture, and then try to just assume we could transplant that into this environment. So it was a very, I think, interesting for me lesson in taking the time to actually think through and understand the kind of change you want to create and how to make that change sustainable.
Really interesting. What a great story. Not many people can tell a story like that. Moving from IT in another country to suddenly helping local farmers under Mandela. Amazing.
Yeah, and it was. It was an absolutely wonderful opportunity. And you know, from my point of view, very enlightening. And South Africa at that time was a great place because we were doing a lot to address diversity within the workplace and change a number of things about you know, where South Africa had been. And it was very uplifting.
And so how does your experience at BAT compare to some of your more latter experiences with CSR?
I think it gave me a lot of lessons. It gave me good insight into what works and doesn't work and how easy it is to sort of come up with pet projects that you think are right, but actually you need to engage with the community or the stakeholders that you are looking to help in order to really understand what it is they need. It's very easy to sort of sit in with the best of intentions in your corporate bubble and make assumptions about what it is you need to do and how you need to do it. And I think, you know, my advice to anyone embarking on this is if you want to have social impact, spend a lot of time understanding the stakeholders, the people or the organization or the group of people you want to help or the change you want to create and from all the angles and engage other people who have views on that community or that change before you decide, oh, this is what we need to do.
Yeah, I think that, you know, given the story you've just told, that's incredibly useful for others. And so moving on to your experiences at Nando, for example, where you mentioned they also had some CSR responsibilities that they took on.
Yeah, and I think if you asked anyone who's been at Nando's, we would never describe it as CSR. Nando's, right from its creation in 1987 in South Africa, and the shareholders that are still the founders and still engaged, will tell you at the very heart of Nando's, there is a purpose of changing people's lives. And that purpose plays out day to day. And actually, it's probably the third organization, but one of the most profound where I've seen that purpose be talked about as much as the business results and the business strategy. In fact, it almost becomes intertwined when done well with the business strategy. But it's a very honest changing people's lives because the decision is always to start with our own employees. Because how can we go off and do things outside the organization? And Nando's works in 26 countries, including South Africa, Southern Africa, the Middle East, Southern Asia. So some countries that have some real challenges in terms of poverty and development and upliftment. How can we do anything outside the organization if we're not looking after our own employees first? So give you an example of that. In South Africa, in my time there, the guys did an awesome job of holistically looking at how they could uplift their employees from a point of view of I guess a CSR lens, but really about that changing life. So for one example, they decided to give all employees in the restaurant very basic medical cover. And that was a huge step and it was unheard of in the industry. In fact, unheard of almost across South Africa. Obviously had a significant cost. And this would allow the employees to see a GP, to get their eyes tested, to see a dentist, to do very simple things that we take for granted, but had an absolutely massive effect. And something that, you know, when you try and put the payback on some of this stuff, which is definitely probably worth talking about at some point, very immediately we're able to see through employee engagement, through sickness rates and other things, that it had a very positive sort of payback in those terms. But that was never the intent. It was all about improving access to the basic healthcare that employees at a restaurant level of earnings in South Africa just couldn't get that kind of private medical support.
Excellent. Another great example. And in terms of how did they go about, so you mentioned that they probably over-indexed, albeit not necessarily through a CSR lens, but they over-indexed on bringing that out with their annual reports, etc. BAT also did that, but probably separate to figures. And so this is still an area, I think, that's maturing on how does a company go about reporting CSR. There's no obligation on them to, there's no rules and regulations.
Yeah. No, and I think that's a great point. And we debated quite a lot in Nando's about how to begin to quantify, were we really changing people's lives? Because it was very much at the heart of the business and if you like, the heart of the values. But we constantly asked ourselves, you know, are we actually achieving that? So each of the businesses started to look at their own individual impacts. And obviously in different parts of the world, they there are different needs and different stakeholders that the businesses were trying to support out with their own employees. So in South Africa, they looked at a number of dimensions of where they were having positive social impact, and just started it in the first instance to quantify numerically what was happening. So I'm just looking at something here I've still got that South Africa did. From a point of view of the way in which they, we also had a savings scheme in South Africa where each month people could put money aside for Christmas and the start of the school year, because in South Africa the school year starts in January. So it's often a time where people on relatively low wages have to go to loan sharks and those type of high interest loans to get through the Christmas New Year period for school uniforms and presents and everything else. So, you know, 4,000 families, we increased their disposable income because we managed to pool the saving every month and agree with one of the banks they would give an advantageous interest rate to all that pooled savings, and then we would all be paid out in December. 50,000 lives we increased with access to support in the way we did things. 3,500 employees took up the medical aid. So we started by, I think, trying to quantify the numbers and the impact without necessarily putting a financial gain on it.
And what came first? Because it's interesting you say, you know, they started from a place of doing good for people. BAT would probably not claim the same. In terms of, did BAT earn the profit and then decide to spend money on CSR? And was that the same for Nando's? Or was Nando's inverted in that they said, no, it's part of our purpose, therefore it's automatically funding is derived and allocated?
Yeah. I think they are different, and that's a good question, because undoubtedly BAT, having been around for over 100 years plus now, didn't do a lot of this stuff as many industries that old didn't. I think the idea of a socially conscious business, a social purpose business, has gained momentum quite rightly, and I think has come into businesses like BAT and other large corporate organizations, I guess, that have that longevity. So they're, and I don't mean this pejoratively, but they're kind of retrofitting it into their view of P&L, and also they're trying to convince their stakeholders in the point of view of the analysts, perhaps the PLC board, you know, fund managers who are investing in them, that it's worthwhile doing. And I think that's quite a challenge. Someone like Nando's, and if I call out two other organizations, I joined an organization called ROC, which was originally set up as a building business in Exeter, and the chief exec, a great guy called Garvey Snook, took that business, bought it, and used his own experience as a child with his father in the construction business when they had the bad winters of, wasn't around just, but 1963, four, I think, and also when his father was injured. He remembers the family having no money. It was in construction, there was no sick pay, and if there wasn't work, you were just sent home. And he set up Rock as a business whereby, unlike most construction businesses, the bodies on the site and working were often referred to as skins, were all subcontracted. No commitment to holiday, pension, health, anything. He set it up so 80% of our workforce was employed. They got a pension, they got medical cover, they got holidays. And that was his passion. And Rock grew to be a £1.1 billion business, very successful in its time. Garvis appeared in the Sunday Times and various, you know, CEO of the Year kind of awards. But for him, everybody who joined the company went to their headquarters, sat through a three-day induction, whatever level you joined the company. So on my induction, you know, I sat there with young apprentice plasterers and electricians and, you know, a real mix of people. And he would personally come down and explain why Rock was the way it was. So there was a business that was kind of halfway between, I guess, Nando's and BAT. It was classically, it was a PLC, it had all those pressures, but it had been set up by a CEO's deep-held values that as a child, he went hungry, he saw the impact on his family of the way that industry operated, so he set out to change it. And I think that's, you know, that's probably, to answer your question, an example of something that's in between the two, I guess, a little bit. So it is fully commercial, reports publicly, but still has this deep set purpose at its heart.
And in current administration, whichever country you're in, it seems that we rely on people's moral compass to decide how much they fund, how much they get involved, where it appears in their priorities, etc. I don't know if you have a view on how do you prioritize CSR? It must be extremely difficult to be able to draw financial benefits, certainly not directly. It might be indirectly, and it might be some way down the road, through reputation, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm fascinated by how businesses are not obliged to do this. So it's down to a moral compass somewhere within that C-suite, and a risk of, not spoiling their reputation, and at the same time, keep shareholders happy with profit levels.
That's part of the challenge. I totally agree, and you'll get a range of views around any C-suite table as to how important it is, and also people's exposure to it, because I think for some people it is still painting scout huts at the weekend, or doing gardens for old people's homes, or and whilst there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, it really isn't changing anything fundamentally in society. But I think as IT executives, there are opportunities in the way we just do business. So when we're at Nando's, give credit to the UK business, they set out on a campaign of looking to source IT hardware in a more environmentally sustainable way. And there is a British standard all around greener information technology, both from everything from cabling to data centers to both the construction of say laptops, where those materials are sourced, and then how recyclable or disposable those assets are. It's kind of there, and it has evolved. Now the challenge we had of then taking that wider across various countries and actually finding hardware suppliers who would even begin to comply with those standards was a journey. We were lucky enough in the UK, access to a lot of very sophisticated vendors and hardware suppliers that we were able to do that. But it meant we had to go around the world talking to our partners, if you like, and our suppliers about, okay, how can we drive this forward, guys? How can we use less energy in the data center? How can we use, source better, more recyclable devices, whatever it may. And it was just always then became part of the decision-making criteria as to how we did that. And I think, even if your organization perhaps doesn't see this as front of mind, I think that's, less and less organizations now. And I think there's a real dialogue as as executives, if we're able to sit at the C-suite table and bring some consciousness around this to the table, then I think we should, if it's not already there. But also we've got a contribution to make. And you know, before I guess we preach to others, quite often the best place to start is our own backyard, and just think about, do we really make good decisions in the IT organization, in the digital organization, whatever it's called these days? Do we make the best decisions we could about helping people? What have we got? What links have we got with local schools to help, you know, disadvantaged kids understand things? I mean, in South Africa, we work with a brilliant organization called We Think Code. And what they did is that it's originally based on a French model, but they took it to South Africa. There's an online game, if you Google We Think Code, with no instructions. If you could play that game and win, you have demonstrated a natural propensity for coding. And what they did is that this is open site for anyone in South Africa, anyone between 17. In fact, I don't think there's an upper age limit, but they didn't want to pull people out of school. They offer then a two, three week induction where if you get through the game, you get invited, you come along. There's a series of then tests and further development to just hone it in. Get through that, and whoever you are, from whatever education you have or haven't got, you're then offered a 2-year coding apprenticeship with a guarantee of a job at the end. I think, you know, you see organizations like that really thinking about it differently, and they've proven, and it's based on some very good psychological research, I guess, that some people's brains are just wired well for that kind of role. And it's got nothing to do with how well, what exams you left school with, you know, whether you've done a degree or not. And we went there, they're both in Joburg and Cape Town, and just a complete eclectic mix of people, but really inspirational. So I think, you know, there is opportunities for us to engage, find those really interesting, innovative partners as part of our ecosystem, and just challenge our own industry, if you like, to think about our impact.
Yeah, that I've not heard of that. That's fascinating. So moving on a little bit. So what's your experience in working with other leaders and how they manage the tension between, you know, growth, profit, the shareholder view of things, if CSR returns are not, you know, immediate or even direct, because a lot of shareholders just want to see the direct nature of these things.
Yeah, I think it's the same as a lot of tensions you get in organizations. You know, when things are going well, it's very easy. You know, many organizations look good when economic conditions and markets are favorable. Was it Warren Buffett said, it's only when the tide goes out you can see who was swimming in the nude. And I think, you know, he's kind of referring to more to sort of balance sheet strength and company strength, and very relevant to today's context. But you know, I think that's where you get to see whether, and it's like all the values in an organization. It's only when you hit hard times or difficult times you get the real values demonstrated. And then I think, you know, I've been lucky. Most of the organizations I've worked with, in fact, all of them, have never lost that sense of ambition, that sense of wanting to have a socially responsible purpose. Now, some have been more profound and better at it, but you know, it's never been written off. Sometimes you have to just pause and you know, play the long game and realize that right now, let's not push that as fast as we might have liked or do as much. But it doesn't also always have to, you know, be a cost issue. I think when you start to engage employees, even more so these days, in, you know, as the generations, you know, widen in terms of their perspective, I think, you know, there's a lot of ways you can do a lot of good just by changing the way you do things without necessarily having to increase any costs. And I think that's probably the first thing I'd challenge is, why does it have to cost more? Why do we think it has to cost more? And I'm not entirely sure it does. And, you know, some organizations are great things, like, you know, everybody has, I certainly worked in one organization where everybody had 5 days a year they could devote to whatever social purpose they personally felt important, which is a different way of doing it. Now, I can immediately imagine a CFO or HRD saying, well, they could be off fishing, you know, singing at home, having a duvet day or whatever. And yeah, maybe they have. And, you know, that's just a normal management problem. But actually, the vast majority of people, if not, you know, nearly all, took those days and did something that was important to them. And then that, in terms of their engagement with the organization, their sense of worth of what that organization does goes up dramatically.
And I think we'll delve into that a little bit more, where we talk about the employees, in particular the Gen Z coming through, and the wave that that might bring with it. But before we get there, we were talking about, you know, what you'd seen as a CIO in the past, but what can you see in terms of CSR activity in the future, and what's the CIO viewpoint of that?
I just think it's going to become increasingly important for business and commercial organizations to understand they have a social role in society. It isn't purely about the profit motive, isn't purely about shareholder return is important because the shareholders have lent you their capital and said, go do with this, give me a return, or I'll take my capital and put it somewhere else where I get a better return. And that's a reality. I mean, that's what we have to understand about the way in which, you know, free markets work. However, I don't see that as mutually exclusive to thinking about ways that as you do your business, you do good. As a minimum, perhaps have a think about where you do harm. If you can just reduce harm, you're doing good. And I think, you know, that it's very easy to try and look for the big killer project, the sort of silver bullet. And actually, it's the small day-to-day things that can often change. So, you know, to answer your question, I think it's going to become increasingly important. I think for Gen Z, but actually, you know, in my experience, it's all generations and ages. Really respond positively to it, and customers I think are starting to value it more. I'm starting to look for it more, and kind of have an expectation. And I think in terms of brand reputation, if you are a consumer brand, certainly if you B2C and have some kind of consumer profile, you know, the reputational damage and the brand damage is going to happen if you get it wrong or you don't do something. Is massive. And you know, with social media these days, I think we all know how fast something can travel. You know, the days of a corporate affairs department or, you know, a good PR agency being able to, you know, manage a message, I think as Dominic Cummings has recently found out, it's you know, there's nowhere to run to, there's nowhere to hide, not even in Barnard Castle. I do think it's not going to go away. I think it'll get more sophisticated, and I hope it will become much more of, to your point, one of the ways in which an organization's performance is evaluated.
We're certainly seeing the change. I mean, they've been doing it for a while now, but even companies as big as Apple taking old devices now, finally, you know, there was a secondhand market for those things, but now you can easily recycle them through Apple themselves. So small things like that, all the way through to the points you raised about data centers being more green, you know, purchases being more green, but also, you know, the World Economic Forum has brought about, I think it's 17 different ways in which companies can think about how they can help the rest of the world around poverty, the greenhouse issues, etc. So there's a vast array. The pressures are clearly coming from consumers and shareholders, not shareholders, but other stakeholders. It's just this, at the moment, while it's not an obligation, it's quite interesting to watch the rate of change and how companies take this on board as something that actually, to your point earlier, there is likely more reputational damage for not doing something, or at least showing that you're doing something.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, there's upsides and downsides to regulation and making it compliant, because the great danger is you just then get kind of people gaming the system in some respects. I mean, certainly in the fund world, if you look at the investment fund world, there's an increasing focus on funds which only will invest in those companies who are demonstrating, you know, some form of social responsibility and purpose and social good, if you like. You know, I think there's a question as to, is it changing fast enough? And you know, is there a regulatory stimulus that could improve things? Certainly when we were in South Africa, even back in the early noughties, you know, there was an industry award for corporate social responsibility, which, you know, as a tobacco company, we won, you know, nationally, which obviously caused some furore and you know, press on both sides of that particular argument. But I think it's only really meaningful if it's done genuinely and authentically. And the great danger is if you try to regulate it, you get some kind of, you know, superficial. And hopefully people, both, you know, to your point on Apple and consumers, hopefully consumers and employees, you know, will move to those companies that demonstrate the right behaviors and the right values. And those, you know, those companies that don't, well, you know, it's a free market and they'll struggle and either they'll learn that actually it's something they do need to do, or they'll cease to trade successfully. You know, and I guess that is in some respects the free market philosophy. You know, I think it's for me personally a little bit debatable as to how effectively you could regulate it, because of your point on, you know, it's so difficult to measure.
Yes.
How do you define it? You know, and I think that's at the heart of the problem. Yes. But I think if there's pressure to do it from enough angles, and I think in my experience, it's moved on massively in my career from relative lip service, you know, good intent. But now my experience of it's sort of fully embedded in many organizations.
Yeah, and it's forming part of brands and campaigns behind those brands. You can see that more and more. With the advent of recent events around COVID, very topical, it's interesting to think whether global companies in particular will revert to old habits of filling office blocks, traveling all over the world for meetings, or whether they too will use the opportunity to reset and hit their own green button.
Yeah, and I think it's in a crisis like this where it's interesting to see how different companies have reacted just in their response to the crisis. And because I think, you know, it's often, and it's not until you get a crisis, you get a true perspective of how an organization, how individuals truly value things. And it's probably too early days to see this, but, you know, I'm sure there are companies out there who have manage their stakeholders, partners, customers, employees in a positive way, and there are going to be those who perhaps haven't done that anywhere near as helpfully. You know, and you know, I think pharma is a good example. You know, that industry has built up a reputation for some quite difficult pricing practices, some, you know, challenging kind of behaviors. And yet now they're at front and center in terms of the pandemic response and you know, our capability to deal with it. And the big debate about, well, who's going to come up with a vaccine if someone does? How's that going to be marketed? How's it going to be shared around the world? Do you look after your own country first? You know, how do we, because there's no way we can manufacture enough vaccines in 1 year to vaccinate the whole world's population. How are we going to face that challenge? And you can already see in some of the debates going on about, you know, the US throwing $1 billion into one company, AstraZeneca, and then AstraZeneca saying, well, you know, we'll give the US first shot at the vaccine, and then there's an upcry, and that's kind of been backed away from. So I think, you know, you're right. The full understanding of how this pandemic's going to play out against some of those social values yet to be seen, but undoubtedly there will be those who do see it as an opportunity to change and do things in a better way.
And it feels like, to your point earlier, it's a growing importance. Do we think there's a point where being non-CSR is actually acceptable? You know, should the leaders of today start thinking about switching to having CSR activities regardless, even if that replaces some direct growth strategies? Because at the moment, it's one area you could define some USP, for example.
Yeah, and I guess I would advocate and support changing the terminology, because I think if you phrase it as CSR and some activities, it's in danger of being interpreted as something you do outside the day-to-day business. It's an extra.
Yes.
You know, my experience, I think when it's been most profound for me, my experience has been, how do we do what we do, do less harm and do more good? So, you know, whether that be within the bounds of the technology organization or the whole organization, whatever it may be, indeed in our individual lives, how do we start to make small changes that do good in, and I think that then builds actually a more profound change in a way than trying to find, you know, the activity we should do this year that will demonstrate we're socially responsible.
So you think bring it into more of a value based type of arrangement?
Yeah, it's how in conducting the business you conduct and in taking the decisions you take, how can you have a more positive impact? And you know, in Nando's, each function had to define, alongside its sort of more conventional strategy and business plan, how it would influence the purpose of changing people's lives. And you know that was part of forcing us, if you like, to think about, okay, of all the activities we do and all the projects we've got and the way we're just doing what we do, how can we bring our purpose and that social benefit, or that societal benefit, if you like, into how we run the business? And I think that's really the powerful thing, rather than a business kind of carrying on being a business and finding some things on the side that it could do as sort of activities. And I'm not suggesting you meant that, but there's always that danger you kind of get that tick the box,
yep,
kind of approach, which I don't think is such a profound change.
Oh, that's a really good point. Nigel, we're nearing time. Is there anything else you want to share on your experiences? I mean, you've had some great stories already that tell exactly what many of us would wish to hear and learn from.
I don't think so. I mean, I have been very lucky to work for some organisations, and perhaps that's why I ended up working for them and what appealed to me about them when I started talking to them. Certainly it was an element. And I think I do believe most people have a positive intent in how they live their lives and what they want to do. So I would say don't be overwhelmed by feeling you have to start something big. Go to that, as I've mentioned, that sort of what activities we currently do that we could just do slightly differently that actually would reduce any harm or do good. And I think everybody in their lives and in the way they do their business can do that. And then for those who do have the opportunity, whether it be in the C-suite or in some other forum, just ask the question is, you know, could we do things differently? Could we do things better? How important is this to us? If everybody did that, I think the world of business, you know, and the world in general would be a very different place. And I would certainly, just going back, harping back a little bit to the BAT experience, engage with all your stakeholders, even the ones that might be slightly adversarial, because that's an important voice to hear.
Yes,
a really important voice. And that was quite a profound experience. It's not easy to do, and not everyone who's adversarial will want to engage. But every business kind of has, some side of it that is. You know, perhaps a little more controversial, or there's people who speak against it, but do try and engage with the stakeholders and understand the context in which your business operates.
Nigel, that's fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure. So thank you for your time and your insight, and look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Not at all, Ken. Really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to the Change Society podcast. Sullivan & Stanley is an award-winning specialist change consultancy that deploys expert teams to solve the challenges companies face when undertaking change. To find out more, please head over to our website, sullivanstanley.com.